and with Bernstein, that was interesting.
Yeah.
And I also watched your talk about just where you rehashed how you got into this and changing your name and that. So, good work. Hopefully you're picking up, getting some guests. Did you speak with E. Michael Jones this week?
No, I haven't. I mean, he sent me a note saying he wasn't feeling well. I'm going to let that one lie for a week or two and then see. I mean, he might not really want to come on with me right now to talk about what I want to talk about, but we'll see. I talked about how I used to be a very outspoken conservative in Boston, to the degree that I actually ran for Congress. And I mean, everybody knew who I was. Now I'm an underground outspoken conservative. I mean, it's the bottom line. I mean, I literally have had to change my identity in order to do what I'm doing here. And the result is, as I said, that I have taken on the last name of my grandfather, who ironically changed his name to from Moskowitz, mainly because of anti-Semitism at that time. And because he was having problems being too visibly seen as a Jew. He was a very educated man, but he didn't have skills. And he was scrounging for work back then, just new to the country.
And, you say white pass. I mean, if it's like a critical race theory type of language, but it says that your grandfather changed his name so that he could white pass.
He could pass as white, exactly. Or at least that he wouldn't be too visibly identified as a Jew, really, is what it came down to. And, it's kind of ironic that now I'm doing the same thing. I've had to change my name so that I'm not too visibly identified as a conservative and as a supporter of Trump in the atmosphere that I operate.
But God forbid that the opposite way, you're not too visibly identifiable as white, where now it's more beneficial to be identifiable as Jewish than white.
Possibly, but I will tell you, it's been interesting in a way, in that now that I'm developing the Moskowitz name, people, when they see me and when I have them on my program and I'm interviewed by them, you can see that they really know that I'm a Jew, and they're thinking, Jew, Jew, Jew. People make weird comments, which I'm not offended by, and I'm not going to mention names, but they'll say things like, oh, I know that you people think X, Y, and Z. and I didn't discuss anything to do with Judaism. It's just because of the last name.
Well, I love being Jewish and talking about Judaism. So, I don't mind somewhat bringing that upon myself, but even so. Yeah. That depending on what you're trying to do, but if you love Judaism, talking about Judaism,
oh, I'm happy to.
There's nothing better than being a visible Jew.
Oh yeah, and I don't mind it at all. I just think it's interesting to note that people think it. They're like conscious of it, and whereas when in my previous last name, which was very non-ethnic and very, Protestant and generic, nobody
Anglo, not non-ethnic, exactly. But it was like Anglo.
Very Anglo.
You didn't choose an African or Eastern sounding. No. You chose an Anglo sounding.
I chose the most.
Like the majority of American Jews.
That's right. Like a Smith and Jones kind of a name. It was the most generic name. So people didn't think one way or the other about my ethnic background, whereas now with the name Moskowitz, they do. So it's just interesting. It's kind of like it's a different experience. And I think it's great. I mean, to me, it's almost liberating. I feel like I'm more myself in a way. I mean, I'm almost honoring my ancestry in a real way. So, it's all been very interesting. But Dovid, I obviously want to talk a little bit about the horrendous event in Texas. We have to talk about that.
Thank I just God. Watched right before we were starting the ADL special today. I mean, God forbid. I mean, it really seemed like a nothing burger. I saw the. From the details, I'm not sure if you looked into the details. You want me to break down what I've deciphered from
yes.
What
happened? Yes, I do want you to break it down, but let me just quickly share my own observations on it. It particularly bothered me that right during the event, or shortly after, when we were watching the breaking news, the FBI came out with the absolutely ridiculous statement that this was not targeting the Jewish community. Really? I mean, this guy, this radical Islamic terrorist, comes into the United States right under the nose of the FBI, a known figure in Britain. He goes to a synagogue you know, where there is people observing Shabbos, assumedly Jews, and he goes there to try to blackmail them and hold them hostage so they'll release this radical anti-Semite. And this isn't a Jewish event. I mean, they're not targeting Jews. You know, it really, the FBI has become so rotten. I mean, maybe it's because of, you know, they mastermind, in my opinion, the incursion in the U.S. Capitol. They basically instigated the, you know, the attempted kidnapping of Governor Gretchen Whitmer, which I think she was hoping to use to run for president. And it goes all the way back to the first World Trade Center attack in New York. People might remember that there were FBI agents right there in the, you know, driving in the car with the guy who planted the bomb in the basement of the World Trade Center in 1992. I mean, what the hell is wrong with them? I mean, they're, you know, it's like they've become, it's not so much political. And, you know, I know in the old days, I mean, J. Edgar Hoover was doing these terrible things too. He was bugging Martin Luther King, you know, and spying on him and blackmailing him and sent him a note saying, we recommend that you either we're going to expose you or you should commit suicide. I mean, so this isn't new to them, but at least, you know, in the old days, they would go after some real bad people like the mafia and the Communist Party and the Ku Klux Klan. Now they're going after Americans. They're responding to a letter which calls parents who are criticizing critical race theory at school boards domestic terrorists. I mean, they're instigating events that make it look like there's domestic terrorism. If we got rid of the FBI, we would really probably get rid of about 80% of these domestic terrorist events and white supremacy. It would, you know, they're the ones that are fanning the flames of it. And I also would just say about the hostage taking in Texas. I don't know about you, but I did attend an event to hear talk about it. And it was just a lot of absolute drivel. They said nothing about Islamic terrorism. They just talked about, oh, we have to stop hate. Yeah, really? Like anybody's, I'm against that, you know. We have to all sit around and become more communist and have love and get rid of such institutions as that separate us. Just the same old crap. Nobody talked about whether or not there should be security put in synagogues right now, whether or not this could be a bigger problem. You know, it's almost like, I mean, when the thing first came out and I heard that it was a Muslim terrorist who was holding the hostages, I kind of breathed a sigh of relief, at least. God forbid that, I mean, horrible, but that it wasn't, you know, set up, you know, some white supremacy type thing. But it seems like the left has just proceeded as if it is anyways, regardless of what it was. And there, it's just, it's dangerous. It's not productive. It's not useful for dealing with potentially a real problem here. What say you, David?
Yeah, I mean, so maybe we should separate this into a few separate areas of conversation. I mean, and first, that, I mean, it's related to what I told you, how in Israel they don't call those acts of terrorism of war anti-Semitic. They're specifically a political terrorist act of war, and it's not in the same classification of anti-Semitism. So I would say that probably not an anti-Semitic act, and it's probably better for us as Jews that it's not considered anti-Semitic. This was a international act of terror
against Jews.
No,
it's an act of terror, and it's motivated
against the United States or against the Jews. So you say, like, well, no, I mean, this guy really didn't have a problem with the United States.
No,
he just had a problem with the Jews.
Yeah,
that's, I mean, it's kind of like 9/11 in Israel, and going like we've had this debate multiple times. And so, okay, did the U.S. go to war with Afghanistan and Iraq as a favor to the Jews or for our own purposes? And so if you're going to say, like, no, the U.S. didn't go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan as a favor to Israel or due to pressure from Israel, did it for our own purposes. So to say this man didn't commit this act of terror against the Jews, he did it against America, and it was related to America's international policy, that he may have chosen a Jewish target for his act But it was act of war from a foreign citizen from
against Americans, absolutely
from a hostile government, and it just happened that he chose a Jewish target. And
but it didn't just happen.
And if you're a non-Jewish American, you say, like, well, no, I mean, these guys don't really hate us that much. They hate the Jews. And so, like, God forbid,
if
you're Pakistani or Iraqi or Iranian or Syrian or Lebanese, they say, like, well, it's really the Jews they don't like. And I mean, but you look at it from multiple levels to say, is it in your interest or the Jewish community's interest to try to say this was an act of terror against the United States, or
it was both? I mean, it's in our interest to tell the truth of it. It was both. It was an attack on the United States, and it was an attack specifically on Jews. If they had come here to attack a church, it would have been an attack on the United States, and it would have been an attack on the Christian church at the same time.
But it's unclear it was an attack on Jews also.
He went to a synagogue, and he tried to hold Jews hostage because he wanted to release this terrorist, who, by the way, is an anti-Semite. I mean, during her trial, she actually said that she wanted her lawyers to have DNA.
She went to Brandeis. I mean, like, I know that. Her story. It's like she went to a Jewish school. She went to Brandeis.
I mean, no, on. I'd like to hear them interview.
Like, she went
Brandeis.
To school in Boston in your area. Like
yeah, she did.
How is this horrible?
Well, it's an interesting question.
Brandeis alumni.
David, it's an interesting question. I'd like to see someone interview to Brandeis and at MIT who knew her. She might have become radicalized, but the fact
that Allison Walker also, Allison Walker, the African-American BDS activist, is also a Brandeis alumni.
Yeah, Brandeis, I could tell you some things about Brandeis.
Well, it's in your area, right?
It is in my area, it's on the street. But the point is,
what kind of anti-Semite comes to America and specifically goes to a Jewish school?
Plenty of them do. But the point is,
specifically enroll in a Jewish school.
Specifically Brandeis.
I mean, she got into MIT. Like, presumably, she had some affinity to Jews. She could have went to another school. Like, if she rolled in Brandeis,
issues. Brandeis has some issues. But the fact is that during her trial, she wanted the defense lawyers.
I heard that.
But I want to say it for the listeners. The prosecution had to take DNA tests to make sure they didn't have any Jewish blood. I mean, she's openly anti-Semitic.
Pakistan.
And she's a terrorist.
I was saying that she's Pakistani, and Pakistan currently doesn't have diplomatic relations with Israel. In fact, you could even look like Pakistan as conceivably in a current state of war against Israel. So you say, American Jew, that, like, no, I mean, like, you're at war with Pakistan, and you might not look at it that way, and I even look into this case, like, I saw they post, like, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar have been active in trying to get this woman released from prison. Even the case, like, 86 years in prison, she didn't even shoot anybody. It's like,
no,
just
she did shoot somebody.
Well, no, she didn't.
No, there was a struggle. She grabbed the gun and she fired some shots. I don't know if she hit anybody.
Yeah, she didn't hit him. And she's the one who got shot. It's like 86
right,
years in prison for attempted. Yeah, but it's like 86 years in prison for she didn't even put a bullet.
Attempted murder of a military man while in custody. Yes. Not to mention the fact that she was brought in custody because she had plans to dynamite. I mean, she was an Al-Qaeda active military soldier. I mean, by any definition, and I don't even think that's disputed.
So it's unclear. Like, I mean, I'm going to tell the information I've heard that I was able to decipher from the case. And, like, God forbid, it seems like mostly incompetence, like, from the rabbi and the synagogue's point of view. Like it was like this guy was like mentally ill and homeless. Let's say that it was an act of terror from some sort of Pakistani organization. You know, due to the fact that Israel and Pakistan are at war, and Pakistan has failed diplomatic relations with America, and this guy purposely came to America to, you know, an old school, like 70s, like the old school PLO, that it was an act of terror for the explicit purpose of having a prisoner released. And I mean, it sounds like this guy was just some homeless, mental disturbed person, but even if it could be demonstrated that he was part of, like, you know, some extremist organization, and his goal was explicitly to take Jewish hostages in order to demand the release of what they consider a political prisoner that's unjustly in U.S. prisons, and so, I mean, you that in saying that, I mean, so is that your understanding of the situation? At some point, I'll tell the story of what I learned from listening to the rabbi. But if you wanted to put this guy so I mean, this guy looks like he's mentally disturbed, and he was in a homeless shelter. I mean, a gun's a good weapon. Like, God forbid.
I mean, look, both things are true, apparently. I mean, I think it's safe to say that he was mentally disturbed, and I think that's how he's been described by
people. You think that this rabbi was incompetent?
Well, let me just talk about the terrorist.
I mean, God forbid, I'm saying the rabbi deserved it. This rabbi was completely incompetent.
No, he wasn't. The rabbi actually was well-trained. He threw a chair at him and they got everybody out.
There's no way, like, this guy had a gun in 10 hours. Like I'm saying, gun's a good weapon.
Rabbi was apparently had a terrorist.
It wasn't Krav Maga. Like, he threw a gun and he threw a chair and ran after 10 hours. He didn't disable. He didn't take the gun.
He was able to.
It was just one mentally disturbed person. I don't know what your point is,
David, but
he wasn't like an IDF hero that, like,
no, but he was able to.
Krav Maga and reverse.
He's a regular rabbi. But he was
I don't think there's any chance I wouldn't have disarmed this person.
Look, I don't know.
First thing, this guy threw a chair and ran after 10 hours. Right,
exactly. I mean, he's not a military man. I mean, he wasn't trained.
Well, I mean, even say, like, he was an idiot.
He had ability and enough background, and he did take some training. That he was
able to he took an ADL course.
Is that what he did? All right. Well,
he let this guy in, the guy had bags. He admits that the guy told him a story that didn't make any sense. So he's then like, no, man, I've done
he let him in. He was in the middle of a service.
He walked in off the street
and he said,
That's not what the rabbi said. So you're making up some nonsense. If you listen to the rabbi, I don't see how you would have concluded he wasn't incompetent. That this rabbi was incompetent.
I don't say he was incompetent. I say he was quite competent. He had to deal with a situation that it's unfathomable what he had to deal with. I don't know what you mean.
He dealt with some third level tier criminal homeless guy, mentally disturbed, and it took him after 10 hours. Like, the guy didn't even tie him up. Like 10 hours, he couldn't even disarm him.
What kind of gun did he have? I mean,
don't even have this information, but I mean, the gun may not even have been loaded. We don't even know if this guy's gun was loaded. We don't know the quality of this guy.
I honestly don't think that you or I are in any position to second guess this.
I do.
I wasn't there.
I did security for rabbis. We picked up hitchhikers. Oh. I worked in synagogues. We let crazy people in off the street,
waving a gun and screaming jihadist messages. I mean, apparently for everybody.
That's not what the rabbi said. I mean, just listen to him if you want to break down what he said.
Thank you. Yeah, let's do a rundown on that because I don't know.
I mean, the synagogue was locked. Like, this guy didn't just walk in. The guy came in from a home. It turns out the guy came from a homeless shelter in the area, and the guy came to the door that was locked, and the rabbi let him in. The guy had bags with him on Shabbos. He says the first thing that this guy asked him was, did the synagogue allow homeless people to stay overnight? And then he said he spoke to the guy for, he did a good deed. He was trying to, sort him or feed some homeless guy. But he said he spoke to the guy for multiple minutes, and the guy told a story that didn't add up. It's interesting that, what's this reform? It's a new reform synagogue. Who heard in America a new reform synagogue being built in this majority white neighborhood in the suburbs? I checked the demographics. It's 90% white in the suburbs of this guy walked with bags.
I know what you're getting at with that, David, but
the rabbi admitted that the guy's story didn't add up.
So
he let the guy in with bags, without a security check or anything. And
well, that's wrong. I mean, obviously.
And he questioned the guy, and the guy, well, I was saying that this rabbi was, I said, like, I've done security for synagogues, Charles. I'm telling you, this guy was incompetent. You defending this rabbi saying he wasn't incompetent is not doing any favor
to the Jewish people or to the
security of Jews. And I just listened to what he said.
That's why I'm glad I have you here, Dovid.
He opened the door. This guy had bags. Like, if you were at their synagogue and some homeless guy came in and like, he's got bags with him, you're going to let him in?
Yeah, sounds like
he tells you a story that he admits doesn't add up. Like, who are you? Where are you from?
That's right. Major mistake.
If you're in a suburb that's like 98% white and some guy, like a, you know, a Muslim guy, like with a British accent comes in and I say, like, no, this rabbi was incompetent. It doesn't do the Jewish people any favor to say anything otherwise. I'm not saying he deserved what happened. I'm not saying you might want to call him a hero because he threw a chair after 10 hours, but say, like, this guy definitely did not properly follow security protocol. And he probably did have ADL training. Show how crappy ADL training is.
I'm glad you're here to clear
is.
It up because
they said, like, no, like, maybe if he had IDF training, you know, like, but no, he had ADL training.
And you know something, look, as you know, in my synagogue, he would not have been let in because we have the doors locked and we have people, congregants, including myself at times, volunteering to watch the door. And we also have the local police department parked outside. I happen to go to a major synagogue. I think the smaller synagogues may don't have that level of security, but no, we would
say, like, I've watched the door at my local synagogue.
Yeah.
Like and I you know something, this guy, there's no way.
That's
this
right.
Guy, we would not with have bags. This no, guy, this guy with right. bags in a story that doesn't add up. Like, this rabbi was incompetent. God forbid.
Okay. Right. You're look, it sounds like you're, I'm glad you're here to give this kind of information because, you know, I honestly didn't know the details of how he got into the synagogue. That would not have happened.
He let him in. He admitted this was on the NBC when he said that.
And why did
he let the guy in? He asked him questions, and the guy told him something that doesn't add up.
Not the main story.
And even just to add in, like, the more details that.
Sure.
And so, like, I guess, it, like, at some point, like, he in the service, like, he does pull out the gun. He says he hears a click, and even the rabbi wasn't really clear in his explanation of what happened. He said the first thing he did was demand that he call Rabbi Buchdahl, this New York female who technically, according to you know, Israeli law, is not even Jewish. Her father's Jewish, her mother's Korean, but she went to a famous, you know, she's one of the, I think she's a rabbi at the Park East Synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you remember Rabbi Buchdahl, the half.
I have no idea.
I mean, she's pretty prominent. She sings, she's a cantor. A patrilineal Jew who went to the academy. Mm-hmm. But the first thing he did was demand that he speak to her, and then after, like, the police, and then at some point, I guess from speaking to her, it became clarified that he had, it was something to do with releasing this woman. Mm-hmm. From prison, and saying, even though the first question, like, maybe, you know, like, we may not figure it out, like, whether this guy might not have had any connection to any terrorist organization, how he ended up in Texas, like, why it could even be the FBI. It could be, like, you know, like, he was speaking to FBI informants or who knows, you know, how this guy came, and maybe honestly, like, he was homeless, and, like, he did just want to sleep in the synagogue, but at some point he obviously he had a gun. We don't know what kind of gun or even if it was loaded, but he did take the people hostage. And for 10 hours and just saying, like, no, I mean, if you have a guy with a gun, I mean, he said that he held the gun, you know, cocked in his hand for 10 hours. That's a long time. He didn't like tie the people up. They said that he let them with their cell phones, that the rabbi was, like, texting with the police the whole time. This guy wasn't like a trained terrorist. This guy was a bumbling, mentally disturbed person. I mean, they released the phone call that he spoke to his brother. And like, the rabbi says that this guy legitimately was crazy. He thought that, right. I mean, according to the rabbi's words, that the Jews controlled the world and that mm-hmm. he would be able to get this woman released because the American people value Jewish people so much that we would release this woman. And like, God forbid, to some extent, it might be true. I mean, like, if Philo-Semitism is really the norm in America, and you think that he did get the attention of President Biden, the governor, and everybody. I think he might. I think they even got it. We don't know whether he actually got to speak to this woman, but this woman did make a message that they said that this woman.
What do you mean, this woman? That's Afia, the prisoner.
Yeah, they contacted her in prison, and she sent some message like she completely denounces terrorism and doesn't know who this man is.
Oh, okay.
And recommends that he let the people go, that at least they reported that she and it could be they even let her speak to her. Like they probably won't give us this information,
right?
And it could be like that they actually did have some sort of like terrorist negotiation. Where he was trying to negotiate the release, and they had him speak to his brother. He spoke to this, rabbi, and maybe he did actually speak to this woman, but I mean, say this guy wasn't a trained terrorist. He didn't like okay. tie people up. He didn't
of an amateur or bumbling. Anyway, he certainly does seem to have been.
But, I mean, everyone says he was mentally disturbed.
Right.
He they had a picture of him like he was in a homeless shelter for 2 weeks before. He spent 2 weeks in like a homeless shelter.
But that begs the question, which is that while he was in Britain, he was a part of, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but a part of a kind of a radical movement that wanted to get this woman out of prison and that was supportive of Al-Qaeda. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I think like all Pakistanis want to get this woman out of prison. I mean, like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. I watched Democracy Now, Amy Goodman. She's been trying to get this woman out of prison for like Brandeis. Like probably the official position of Brandeis is that this woman shouldn't be in prison. So I say I would assume that almost all Pakistani Muslims think that this woman shouldn't be in prison.
So it's not because he was connected to Al-Qaeda then?
This guy said he was a father of six people and he was divorced and like, I guess his life fell apart, like whatever.
But was he connected to Al-Qaeda? Because it seems
we have no idea. They haven't really.
Well, it seems like the British.
It appears not. It appears that he was just mentally disturbed.
It does. But at the same time, apparently the British, he was on the radar screen for the British and he was on a list of potential terrorists in terms of his connections to Al-Qaeda. Now, I don't know that, but it seems like. It wasn't just that he was a Pakistani who wants to believe.
No, because he came in, he wasn't on like a no-fly list. I mean, God forbid, Nick Fuentes and the January 6th, like the people you speak to on your podcast are more likely to be on a no-fly list than this man. And just saying how this
Nick
guy
came Fuentes from, is on a no-fly list.
Well, he's going to, well, yeah. I mean, saying like he's going to be testifying. He was part of the January 6th insurrection.
Did he go into the Capitol?
It's unclear whether he went in.
I mean, that's look,
but he is on a no-fly list.
I don't know what the details are with him.
Saying that this man that you're talking about, like, was not on a,
was not
this,
on a
this terrorist was not on a no-fly
list.
He was not American.
He was led into the country, no problem.
He was able to fly from Britain to the U.S. no problem.
And that's a big question because he was. I mean, I think the truth will come out. I'm not saying I know it, but what I've heard about this is that he was on a British list of people associated with Al-Qaeda. I don't know if he was.
But, not enough that, God forbid, it's scary to think about in America. I mean, things like it's not a joke because the reality is the people that you're talking to on the show about January 6th and the election are probably more likely to be on a no-fly list than this man is saying. And so
which
this man
says,
was on a British list and connected to Al-Qaeda. That is the spoil system of the Biden administration that he probably had absolutely no trouble coming to America.
And that brings up questions of it. If he was on a list in Britain, it brings up questions about how that is.
Al-Qaeda is like a...
How is he financed? He was in this country for, I think, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. He was homeless, but yet he seemed to have traveled around a lot. He was able to get a gun. How did all these things happen?
We don't have the detail. I'm saying you could buy a gun for $100. They haven't released the type of gun. And I'm guessing that, God forbid it could come out this gun wasn't even loaded or wasn't even a real gun. They haven't released the information. If it was like an automatic weapon that would have easily been capable of killing all three hostages, God forbid. But I doubt it. And saying he bought the gun
we can't know that
illegally. And even to say homeless people in Detroit, they got guns.
And if one of them walks in,
you can get a gun for like $50, $100. It's not like that difficult in like Texas. Like, I don't know if it'd be expected. That's why I said, for the sake of the Jewish community, that this rabbi wasn't competent.
Maybe, but when you have somebody who's homeless, but they walk into a synagogue with a gun and start demanding that a known terrorist who has been convicted be released, then you have a problem. Now, you also bring up an interesting issue here, Dovid, which is that, some of the people that were on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol are now on terrorist lists, probably.
There are no fly lists. There's a fact. All the people that are connected to January 6th, even the people who didn't go inside, are on no fly
list.
This man wasn't.
Well, first of all, not all of them are, which is something that Revolver.com is looking into. I would check them out. Darren Beatty and Julie Kelly, two very good reporters, have been following the story in that there is a significant number of people who are not on any lists at all and who were apparently playing a major role in that event, including this guy, Ray Epps, who was seen on video, allegedly in the Oath Keepers, telling people, "We're going to break into the Capitol," he's yelling, and people are yelling back at him, Fed, this is all on video. And he's seen at the day of the incursion, whispering into the ear of a Capitol policeman. And basically they were removing the guardrails. They barely had any security and they were letting people in. And there was several other people who also just kind of were never charged with anything. They're not on any list. Ray Epps has never been charged at all. He's never been questioned. He definitely was there. As an instigator, possibly instigating violence. And, it raises the question of whether or not the whole thing was a setup. There were people on the lawn. They didn't apparently.
That's just the way our intelligence organizations operate. That's how they used to operate with the Islamists.
No, with real enemies of the United States, the Ku Klux Klan or the Communist Party. Now they're doing it against people who are Republicans.
It's a spoil system.
That's not what they're supposed to do.
This is a free country. Attorney General.
No.
You shouldn't have district attorney as an elected office, but he has the attorney general. Has the right.
Yeah, they're not supposed to do it. They're supposed to go after not American citizens. They're supposed to go after people that really are involved with either criminal activity like the mafia or are plotting to overthrow the government like the Communist Party or the Klan. Not American citizens talking at school board meetings or going to a protest at the Capitol for free speech.
If you look at Islamic extremists versus some form of white nationalist, and even if you're gonna, God forbid, say that the current administration has deemed that white nationalist, and if they use a broad brush to include what they would say Trump supporters, is a bigger threat to America than Islam.
And that's political.
In this case, this case here is an example of the current state.
Do you agree with that, David?
It doesn't matter if I agree with it.
Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't matter whether you agree with it, but I'm asking you anyway. Do you think it is appropriate for the U.S. government to brand the opposition, the 75 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump and Donald Trump and members of his administration as domestic terrorists? Yes or no?
It doesn't matter what I think.
I want to know what you think. You're here. You're talking.
I'm a smart guy. I don't have opinions on things. I don't have opinions on things I have no power.
The
Serenity Player.
A little hot under the collar here. That you're not going to.
The Serenity Player. Grant me the.
You
power
have free
to,
speech, the, and the I
things
want to,
that I,
want
the
to
things
speak
that
about
I can't
this.
Change.
First of all, you can change it by speaking out.
Speaking out doesn't change it.
Yes, it does change
it. No, it doesn't.
That's why we're doing
it. You've been speaking out for
years. Then why are you here? If you don't want to have any influence, if you don't want to present ideas that can make people think about something, why bother even getting up in the morning?
I believe in life. I just think I just don't think I have any power.
But don't you have any purpose in life?
Of course.
Your purpose in life, you do a YouTube channel. You talk, yeah,
I talk
on
about
issues.
Ideas. I talk about
that's
bad.
Right,
I talk about
because
poor,
you want to get ideas across to people, and you want to have some level of influence.
But I don't have any power of what the current attorney general, no, what the attorney
but
general,
you have
my opinion,
influence.
My opinion, I don't have any influence.
Yes, you do
what the
have influence.
General,
you're a talk show host. You're a citizen.
Just, I'm saying that.
You don't have. I'm not saying you have power.
I'm more interested in correctly informing people of what's going on. Yeah, my opinion, and that's like I say.
Oh, so then you don't express opinions.
My opinion, my opinion doesn't matter. Like,
yes,
I went to good schools and good rabbis. You know, I say like I went to good schools, and they told me my opinion doesn't matter.
Well, they were wrong. Your opinion.
That's why. That's why I was able.
Everyone's opinion matters.
Because I didn't waste my time. You know, I didn't waste my time thinking about what I think is so important.
Everyone's opinion matters. It's not a matter of more or less important, but it all. Have you ever written a letter to the editor of a newspaper? That's an opinion. Have you ever written an op-ed piece in a newspaper? That's an opinion. Do those things not matter?
Of course it matters. My opinion doesn't matter.
Yes, it does matter. Everyone in listening to this program, even if I only have three people in the whole country that listen to me, I don't care. Your opinion matters one way or the other, for better or for worse. It matters. You're supposed to express your opinion. That's part of being alive.
I'm going to give you my opinion. Like, in my opinion, this rabbi wasn't competent. Like,
fine.
In that,
that's an opinion.
That's something maybe I could change in terms of how synagogues deal with security. And to say that this case that we have here was largely caused by the rabbi's incompetence. But
okay.
to say on some form of national, international policy, my opinion doesn't matter. I'm not going to waste my
time. You just expressed
even giving my opinion,
yes,
just to state like something.
You just express an opinion saying that you feel that this rabbi was incompetent. You've made the case. You've given some background. You presented a case, and that is your opinion. And by doing that, you could change perceptions
and any Jew who goes
citizen.
To synagogue, or you yourself, like me, who's sat at the door for security at my local synagogue, and you that maybe takes a rotation and sits at the door for your security, you could think about it.
Exactly.
You could
improve security by expressing that opinion, by talking about we should look at what happened, express our opinions of what happened so we can be safer going forward. So yeah, your opinion matters. And even if you reach a few people, it matters. It could save lives.
Yeah,
so
I understand policy, but saying that the current Justice Department, even if you reached millions of people, it would not change the current system of the Justice Department.
Yes, it would.
You're talking about election. You're saying, okay, you want to influence
and try to influence
elections. Like we're part of the spoil system. We do have elected.
No, it doesn't mean
district
you can just go ahead.
Attorney general is posted and saying that.
But you can have an opinion about it and expose it. Look at.
But I'm saying that you would be a smart man if you recognize your opinion has no value.
No, my opinion has a lot of value. And so does yours.
You mentioned
that there are all these district attorneys that are letting people out of prison with $1,000 bail, and then they go out and they drive a truck through a Christmas parade in Waukesha, Wisconsin, or they shoot a young woman out of UCLA. That is something that you say, well, we don't have any right to say anything because the DA has a discretion. They can do whatever they want. That's the spoil system. No, you absolutely have a responsibility to expose this and express an opinion. And if you do that, public pressure can build and they can put a stop to it, either through an election or make them change because of exposure. That's why we're doing media. That's what the media is supposed to do. They're supposed to investigate and expose things and express opinions and have editorials so that the public can be informed and think about it and it can change it. So yeah, you can have an opinion about whether or not an attorney general in an administration can declare 75 million people in this country domestic terrorists because they're part of the opposition. You can have an opinion about whether or not that's right. You say your opinion doesn't matter. I say it does matter.
Well, I just quote the Serenity Prayer, and I'm looking here, it's actually from Reinhold Niebuhr. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
That's the
AA. This is one of the things
from AA.
I guess the source of it. And it's not, I mean, there's Judaic things, but I'm calling you out on a,
but you can make
on,
a difference
on a basic wisdom. Well,
yeah, the basic wisdom
in life, but you're saying
on these the answer issues, to that is there are some things you can change, and there are things you can change. Yes, you
and therefore having a bunch of opinions, even right or wrong.
Dude, this is the most idiotic conversation. Yes, you can change things.
I mean, that's my
in
opinion.
Some cases. If I decide to go out and say we should abolish the IRS, that would be futile because we're not going to change that. I agree with you. But there are things we can change. We can expose corrupt practices in a government organization. That's our responsibility as sovereign citizens, to express opinions and expose corruption. It is not something you can't change. This isn't a monarchy. This isn't a dictatorship where they just have that kind of power and you can't change it. What the hell are you talking about?
Well, I mean, this is basic civics.
Basic civics is to be involved in politics and to change things. That's basic civics. American
running for office, by saying that you
not just running for office.
You currently
contact people in office. You call them. You say, "I know what you're doing, and I disagree with it." And if they get enough calls, they're going to change. Or they may or may not.
Well, they may or may not. No, it's like, no,
but the point is, you can't based on public feedback. You can do, look, people affected change in Virginia when they went to the school board meetings and started to expose critical race theory and sex education and radical elements of the pandemic response. And it led to the election of a new governor who actually has now sent out executive orders acting on a lot of these things. They did change something. They were citizens. You could say, "Oh, well, why bother?"
I mean, elections have consequences. I'm saying, obviously, but you're not talking about elections. You're just talking about, basically repeating your
elections are one thing that can change it, but public opinion can matter in a lot of areas. Let me give you another example. This is kind of a trivial one, I suppose.
I mean, are you really changing? I mean, you're basically you're talking to me.
In the 1970s,
I mean, maybe tens or hundreds of people.
I don't care if I have two
hopefully
people.
Hundreds of people that might watch
this.
They can
then talk
are
to
you really
else?
Changing anyone's opinion?
Yes, I am.
That watch
look,
it is
look,
it really
let me give
like
you an
beneficial
example.
To just keep on
yes,
repeating
I
yourself?
I am changing things. Let me give you an example.
Well, I mean,
Burger King and McDonald's.
Okay, I mean, I respect you. You ran, but you lost. Like, I mean, Barney Frank beat you fair and square.
Fine, but I changed. But I got him.
You didn't change anything. You lost.
Yes, I did. I got him removed from the Homeless
Security. How do you?
Thank you for asking. Thank you for asking. I did change things. By losing, because I had a moment where I got to speak publicly on certain issues, and I did so, and it changed things. It got him removed from the Homeland Security Committee. It got the people aware of the fact that we had let terrorists into this country due to an act that he passed and promoted because he thought it was bigoted to not let them in. And there were some other things that changed as a result of my candidacy. Just because you lose, you can change things by running because you get a moment where the media has to pay attention and you can bring up a couple of issues that can make people think and it can change things in ways that are maybe imperceptible, but it does. You don't have to necessarily win. I mean, it's great if you do, but you can change things by running. I'm going to give you, let's just hear me out here.
Maybe I'm more like a proceduralist. You're saying like, okay,
this is the procedure. You run and you speak out. Look,
it takes longer if you give your opinion on everything.
That's
so
fine.
Just like
I
these are
long
the facts,
long takes.
Whether you like it or not. And if you want to change the situation, here's the procedure and protocol to go about it. And it just wastes a bunch of time.
No, it is the procedure.
I mean, it's funny because at meetings, school board meetings. I'm the one who studied in Jerusalem.
It's
my rabbis who taught me this. They said, like, you're like, they're the ones who said, I was a dumb,
look,
stupid
I don't
kid
get into what your rabbis
went to liberal
told.
Schools.
What?
And thought
why
that
bother?
My opinion mattered,
why bother?
My
having,
opinion doesn't matter. That
well,
like
I'll
do better in life to just.
You know what, David? I'm not going to even comment on that because I don't know what your which rabbi you're talking about, but. But I will say, why bother having a school board meeting with people coming in and speaking?
You're talking like liberal Americanism.
I want you to answer this question.
Matters. I mean, you're supposed to be a Republican.
A school board meeting where people get up and they speak to the school board if their opinions don't matter. Why bother have the meeting? Why not just do everything behind closed doors? After all, they're elected. It doesn't matter what you think. They can do whatever they want. Why bother have the meeting? Answer my question. Why bother having school board meetings if people's opinions don't matter?
Well, I mean, you're talking procedure and the history of like
that's why bother having the procedure of a school board meeting.
Parliamentarian procedures.
Yeah, why bother having a meeting?
Transparency.
Why bother? Why bother opinions? Why bother? Why bother having the procedure of a school board meeting if people's opinions don't matter?
Well, I think uninformed opinions don't matter.
Who decides what's informed?
And saying like generally the meetings are a waste because you have a bunch of uninformed people.
Who are you to say someone's uninformed? At a meeting, people you give information. You can judge the information.
Well, there's a science of expertise and saying that you're supposed to be a Republican, not a Democrat, and saying that you have experts who've studied the issue.
I would rather hear from regular people, whose parents, whose children are in the school.
I went to liberal schools like University of Michigan, where everybody gets a chance to voice their opinion, no matter how little they know about the subject.
And they should.
No, they should.
David, let me just, I want to
thank God, I'm at Orthodox Jewish school. They taught me better than this stupid liberal nonsense that you're espousing.
I think
you're supposed to be a Republican.
Yeah, and
it's like, no, opinions of uninformed people don't matter. And you don't need to waste your time listening to people who don't know what they're talking about.
It seems to me like
a procedure of parliamentarian.
The stupid liberal school I think, probably a lot better. But Burger King and McDonald's in the 1970s were wrapping their burgers in these styrofoam baskets, these like kind of like styrofoam containers. And due to the information of a couple of activists who said these things are not biodegradable, they're bad, they're going to fill landfills up for 1,000 years, Burger King should switch to like a more generic wrapping, like a wax wrapping or something like that. And they made it into a national campaign that by word of mouth, by getting people involved, pretty soon some ad agencies started getting interested in it. There was a reaction on the part of the public because people were speaking out. And the result was that Burger King and McDonald's stopped using those kinds of styrofoam wrappers. They changed. They changed because of public opinion, because people spoke up. So yes, your opinion does matter. You might be wrong. And if you're wrong, it's probably not going to go anywhere. But in the case of parents at school board meetings, they were probably they made a very cogent case because they have children in the schools. Oh, they're not experts. They don't have a degree in education. Fine. They have sons and daughters in the school who are coming home from school and saying, "Daddy, mommy, people say I'm evil because I'm white or because I'm black, I shouldn't do math because that's what white people do." And the parents had enough common sense to say this stuff is wrong, and they spoke up. They don't have to be experts. They're Americans. That's the basic of our whole system. We are self-ruled people. We're not ruled by an oligarchy. We're not supposed to be. We're supposed to give limited power to government because we are under God. We're self-ruled people. That's the great American experiment. So your opinion does matter.
It's kind of like, don't take financial advice from poor people and don't take political strategy.
Make a choice of who you're going to listen to. But the point is, your opinion still matters. It may be right or wrong. You could argue it, maybe dismiss it, but it still matters. And your opinion about whether 75 million people should be deemed domestic terrorists, the fact that you won't answer that question, it really makes me question your morality. I get the fact that the victor goes to spoils. Yeah, they can do a lot of things. They can put Jews in concentration camps if they want to. But is it right?
Right, it's not right.
Yes, it does matter. I want to know, is it right or wrong for the Attorney General to call these parents domestic terrorists? Yes or no?
Yeah, I don't have
an opinion. You know,
I don't have an opinion. Like, I don't make moral.
You don't have an opinion.
Good or bad judgments on this. Like, I can have my desire for like it's kind of the stupidity. And like, thank God I went to good yeshivas. That these fantasies, like if I were God, you're like, no, I'm never going to be God. You're never going to be God.
So and neither is the Attorney General.
In this playing, like, what would you do if you were God? And saying like, no, you're never going to be God. And it's a stupid
and neither is the government
to pretend like you're going to be God.
Not being God. Government pretending it's God that they
have. I think that there's no way that this guy, I would have disarmed this guy. Like, I mean, say maybe like you can't.
Fine, that's an opinion. And I think it's a good one.
He might have killed me, but it's like, no, I would have fought this guy. I would have disarmed him. I would not have been
a coward. So why are you expressing an opinion about that? I would not have
been a coward and ran 10 hours later. And like one mentally disturbed guy for 10 hours is going to hold me hostage. Like no chance, God forbid. Like that guy would have been dead on the floor. Like if he tried that on me,
there you go,
like he would have, like I was saying, like, no, the FBI wouldn't have put him in a body bag. I would have. And yeah. You know, God forbid. You know, you're talking a situation like that. No, I mean, could be this guy would have killed me, but I'm saying this, how I would have handled that situation. Like I would have fought this guy. Like there's no way
I
would have cowered like a wimp for 10 hours, you know, to some mentally disturbed guy just because he had a gun. And, you know, God forbid, we're talking about, you know, just like anti-Semitism. Like, no, that you're like, you sound like the ADL, like, just like, you know, God forbid, whining like a little bitch, you know, like now we're not on YouTube, but like, no, you whining like a little bitch doesn't help anything. And, you know, it's like the ADL, and you say like, yeah, I mean, like Jonathan Greenblatt and the ADL whining like little bitches doesn't help anything. And saying like, okay, well, like if you're in Israel, this rabbi should have been forced into the IDF. Like he's a disgrace to the Jewish people that have went like
make
that
a good case
as a rabbi, and he should have had mandatory military service.
David, you know, and, look, I mean,
now we're not on YouTube anymore. And just say like, no, this guy was a wimp and a coward and a disgrace to the Jewish people.
Okay.
But it's my opinion. My opinion doesn't mean anything.
Yes, it does.
He's still the rabbi.
No, look, you have some information. I remember, you might remember back in 2001 when Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter, was beheaded, right? You remember that in Pakistan by he went to interview Al-Qaeda. I remember at that time, I interviewed an Israeli security expert who said that Daniel Pearl did not handle that situation right. You don't go there like that. And think you're going to get, you know, some interview in the, you know, with Osama bin Laden. I mean, he actually, you know, he was not experienced. He should have been. And that he really did not do the right thing. God forbid. I mean, it's horrible that he was killed. But he, you know, he wasn't really playing the ball game right. He wasn't using the right kind of experience that he should have used. And that was his opinion. That was not the majority opinion at the time. But I thought that was very interesting, and it changed my way of looking at that situation. Now, you're telling me now that this rabbi was not, you know, experienced and he didn't really handle the situation right. And I take that very seriously. I think you're probably right. You do have some good data on that. You do have some good background on that. And
I would say that, like, this rabbi is a complete example of why these ADL training courses are worthless.
Probably
like,
is.
Like the Orthodox, like here in my area, the Orthodox doesn't let the ADL into their synagogues. Like they're saying, like this isn't, like this guy had ADL training. You can see how worthless that is.
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, I don't know a lot about it, but now that you're talking about it,
he might have had the police. I mean, he had the police in his phone. Like, I mean, he knew the police, like you know, to be connected and good with local law enforcement. And you know, like on all the cowering is saying the police killed this man. And I'm saying like, I mean, it's a bad thing that I mean, this guy was.
By the way, that's a question I have about this. It's actually a question that was raised by someone. Is the fact is that once everybody was out of the synagogue, why did they then kill him?
We don't even know. I'm saying like, they said like that, like whether this guy
was dangerous.
He might not have even had a real gun.
There might have been a reason for that. You know, I mean, and I don't know what it was.
It's possible there was a gunfight and that this guy fired at the police and the police fired against him. But I mean, it's possible he didn't even have a real gun. It wasn't.
Well, that's what we don't know. But I think it's the question
of whether they're going to release this information. And from what I've seen of the story, it was just some third-rate, homeless, crazy person.
Okay.
And I mean, God forbid, danger could be danger. Like a homeless person could kill you. Even the rabbi in Boston, he got stabbed by just a crazy homeless person.
That's right.
Not saying that just because he was a third level, criminal, homeless, crazy person, he couldn't have killed people. I don't think blowing this out of proportion, and even just seeing how the ADL and the national news and watching this rabbi try to cover up his incompetence on national news, like, you know, just saying, yeah, like, he let him in, he spoke to the guy, he admitted on national news, I'm trying to judge this rabbi favor. I'm not saying he's a rabbi, but whatever security training he had was pretty worthless. And even he can't even spin off a story that doesn't cover up his incompetence, because he let the guy in, the guy had bags, the guy gave him a story that didn't add up. This guy's a Middle Eastern Muslim in a 98% white neighborhood, homeless. There's not a big, my neighborhood, there's not a big homeless problem. Like if a homeless person came up to my local synagogue, we're not in Detroit, saying this guy was in the suburbs, there's not it didn't make sense that some homeless guy would be coming up to a synagogue and he's a 98% white area and a Muslim, with an accent and a story that doesn't add up in bags or whatever. And even that he asked them a homeless shelter, you could watch the interviews, but I was saying just with like a little basic logic, you should see this rabbi was incompetent. And, it's a textbook of how not to do security at a synagogue. And, just saying that this guy went through the ADL training. So I mean, just like, this is a textbook.
Which does say something.
Why the ADL
that.
Training is worthless. It even said it wasn't training. Me and you could do some like martial arts or something like that, or you could do like Krav Maga. Like here they have these videos, the Detroit, training where they teach you how to, God forbid, I wouldn't recommend it, but like how to try to take a gun from a person with a gun. He didn't have that kind of training. He had an ADL course, and obviously the ADL course was worthless. I was saying like they taught him to throw a chair at a person. Like, no, I mean, there's no way that maybe to some extent, like throwing a chair could be valuable, but even if like after, but I mean, if we get back to this point of like you insisting that I should make a good or bad a judgment,
I do insist on it
and say that, but I think that's worthless.
I want
you, like, any Jews are watching this and saying that, you're saying like whether this man was good or bad, and saying like it doesn't matter.
Based on what we know, we don't have
saying good or bad.
I mean, as we talk about it, I'm changing my opinion.
Don't mean anything. I mean, say, if a guy attacks you, and let's say like okay, like it was a mistake, it cost him his life. You know, this guy, it cost him his life. You know, not because the rabbi, was able to defend himself, but because of the police and law enforcement, and. Good or bad's a value judgment, and to my enemies it'd probably be good.
If someone
killed me, my enemies would probably say it was good. And if
the Nazis said it was bad that Hitler was there was attempted assassination because they liked Hitler.
Yeah, I mean, so if you're in a bad situation, having an opinion whether your oppressor is good or bad isn't going to help you get out of your situation.
Not
we're
at
talking
time,
the current situation of the downfall
the
of the U.S. government, making some opinion that it's bad isn't going to make one difference.
Yes, it does.
In helping us get out of this situation.
Yes, it does. If we say nothing, then we're going to end up.
I didn't say nothing, but like making these value judgments.
Yes, you make
bad.
A value judgment. If you don't make a value judgment and you don't speak up,
then
we're all going to end
these
up
guys
in
are misguided and dumb. And incompetent.
Fine.
Like, I don't think they're bad. I think they're incompetent.
Okay.
And they're corrupt. But to say that they're bad,
I think both things are true. It sounds like
it's like the Biden administration. I watched all 2 hours of that press conference, and like, God forbid.
Now, what'd you think of it?
I mean, one thing, like he blatantly just forgot to answer questions. Like, I mean, just the last question, for example, when he asked, a lot of the reporters asked two questions. And he asked them like about his promise to cancel the $10,000 in student debt. And they asked him another question. He just completely forgot to even comment.
The man is
a lot of the people asked like multiple questions, and he just completely forgot.
He doesn't obviously doesn't have
the guy. One of the reporters, like I watched one of the versions where it just had the picture on Biden the whole time, so I couldn't see.
It's painful.
Said 49% of America. Think that Biden's in cognitive decline.
He is. You can see it. Anybody with
my parents are younger than Biden, and my mother. I mean, God forbid, she says some like level of cognitive decline. I take care of her. Like he could have said, like, yeah, I'm pretty old. I'm not as sharp as I used to be, I'm still.
He's in cognitive, physical, mental decline. That's obvious. I mean, yeah, my mother, I mean, to some extent, is not president of the United States. I mean,
you know, I think that Harris should probably, like, you know, like, it's just the puppet they're holding him in there. And in my opinion, my reading, I've said it many times, that like the people that are close to him probably knows that he's not all there.
I agree.
And are just, you know, figure that and
they just want to write it out.
But yeah. I mean, the current situation is like, no, I mean, what's going to happen is Kamala Harris is going to become president. Probably. And they'll try to cover up his incompetence and mental decline for whatever period as they can. And then it's going to be handed over to President Harris. And they probably have some sort of political calculation, because like you're saying, that elections have consequences, and we do function under the
spoiling system. Stolen elections have catastrophic
under Trump. That
Steve Bannon likes to say,
you know, under Trump, that there was more, you know, saying the threat of Antifa and you know, immigrants from Mexico and Muslims. And then, you know, elections have consequences. Or even, you know, like, we're not on YouTube, if you think it was the election was fraudulent. And it wasn't the election had consequence, but the fraud had consequences, God forbid. It's a fact now that white nationalists are by our government are considered a bigger threat than Muslims.
They are considered.
And the definition of white nationalism is pretty broad term, really. God forbid, it's unclear.
Anybody that supports Trump. There are questions about whether or not it's a real threat. I don't think it is.
I mean, say if we correctly assess the situation we're in, maybe we could more correctly assess what's the logical thing to do about it. I'm glad my rabbis taught me to think about it like that, where whether they're good or bad is irrelevant. Like, it's my say, like, you know, like if you're under corrupt rulership, your life has to go on. And saying like,
yes, it does. But look, David, we're reaching the end of the show. We should do a whole show about this and what your rabbis say in terms of that you shouldn't make a judgment of whether something's
good. It was ready to even anti-Semitism is saying like, even like, you know, saying like from a orthodox, like, does anti-Semitism even exist? Can you fight anti-Semitism?
Yes, you can.
Like, no, I don't think it does. And I don't think you could fight it.
I think it does. And I think you can fight it.
But I mean, it's related. I'm saying you could learn security. You could be wise in your situation. You could be.
Ideas can have very toxic effects on your neighbors and lies are saying.
But can you fight anti-Semitism?
Yes, you can.
You could fight your enemies.
You could fight it if it violates your rights, if it violates your laws. But you can also advocate against it when you can't. Yeah, you can, and you can learn to understand why it is and what makes it tick, and analyze it as a way to exposing it and diffusing it. Yes,
I had another famous rabbi's son, like, you know, said this to me. Like, I remember it was like just almost shocked. Like, I wasn't shocked, but he said like, I'm a Jew. You know how many hundreds of millions of people want me dead? And if you said like, no, like, I don't look at it that way. But maybe you said like, no, like we're Jews. There's hundreds of millions of people that want us dead. And was this act anti-Semitic? You said, well, it's anti-American. And even from the U.S. government, like, I lived in New York and Homeland Security and these various things, work with the synagogue. You say like the majority of that say like, no, I mean, if enemies of America were to target America, they would think that me and you are more valuable targets than non-Jewish Americans. And whether it's accurate or not, like this rabbi, like,
well, I don't think
that Jews control the world, but say that compared to our Gentile neighbor, that people would consider us a much more valuable target. And it doesn't matter our opinion on it. You say, okay, you're white passing or whatever, because, like, you know, what was my rabbi's son? Right, that like, you're a Jew, I'm a Jew, hundreds of millions of people want us dead.
Fine. I mean, I don't know if it's true that we're more valuable.
And even if you take that, like, you kind of like an Israeli,
no, but we're sort of toward the end
type,
of the
program, attitude, is it more beneficial to take that, you're just like Israel, like I said, like, is it a kill or kill be ruled? And just to take that as a given, like, okay, fact, like, whether you like it or not, whether you think they're good or bad, there's still a lot of people that want us dead, God forbid.
That's right. And it's bad. Anyway, David, just one quick thing is I'm reaching toward the end here, and I have another guest that's going to be logging in hopefully soon. My understanding, I don't know if you have any information about this. I heard Howie Carr mention this here in Boston, that Biden's press conference he's reading off of a card. I didn't really see it. I heard some of it. He has the names of the reporters that he's to call on. It's all set in advance. He calls out the name in order on the card. The reporter then asks a question that they already have given to him. And then he reads the answer, which he has in front of him. There's nothing spontaneous about it. In other words,
it's wouldn't be surprised. I mean, yeah, that's kind of why I said, like, our opinion doesn't matter. Like, let's say you're right. What could we do about it? And I said, like, just watching it, I said, like some of the questions he just completely ignored. And he looked like he was oblivious to the fact that, like, you know, if I, a lot of times, like at the show, I'll tell you like 5-6 points, you're a pretty sharp guy. And you know, a lot of times, like, you'll remember all 5-6 points that I mentioned at the beginning, and we could go through them occasionally. Like, you know, you forget, or I forget, but like, this was just like one question that a reporter asked two questions, and then Biden answered just one of them and went on to the next one. So it could be that you're right, that it was basically rigged like that. Yeah. And that they had the questions and the reporters, because they're reporters, threw in a second question, and Biden was just oblivious, and he just answered the one question and went to the next one without even realizing that he didn't. I mean, is that, you know, basing on, because I did, like, that's why I said I noticed, and adding, if you're right about that, that probably is what happens. They probably did, rig it like that. They probably did have a question in advance, and a lot of the reporters threw in a second question anyways, because they're reporters and that's what they do. And Biden just like didn't even hear it, didn't even acknowledge that second part of the question. Is that,
well, to a certain extent, all politicians do that. They answer the question their way. But
no, I'm saying, like, he didn't even
hear, I don't know,
it. If I asked you 2 points right now and saying, like I watched the conference, and I mean, if you're, I guess we could keep on talking until your guest comes on, but I was saying that what you say is like, call it a conspiracy theory, because we don't know, or maybe there's some kind of like evidence that should be obvious that you're right.
Look, I don't know. I'm not saying they did give the questions in advance. I'm just saying that he's not competent and he doesn't know how to handle something.
I'm putting your information together with what I said.
Assuming this is true.
That say, like, yeah, they probably did rig it in advance, have the reporters and the names and some with the answers, and he had these cards. And then a lot of these reporters probably threw in a second question anyways. Biden like didn't even seem to,
couldn't handle it,
to be aware that the second question was asked.
That's right.
He just answered the one question.
And went, he read off the page, and then he moved to the next one, which is really terrible. I mean, it's outrageous, because, I mean, whether you liked President Trump or not,
it's clown world. It's like
Trump, Trump would have an open discussion with people who were out there.
It's like, it's really clown world.
I've got Chuck Slavin here. All right, David, listen, okay. I want to thank you for joining me. Shabbat Shalom. Have a good one. Thank you very much, David. Okay.
And any Jews watching this, like, you know, take security seriously. Learn from these rabbis' mistakes.
Yes, and thank you for that information. All right. Hello, Chuck. Can you hear me okay?
All right. I can. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for joining me. Now, Chuck, you are a Boston activist, a Massachusetts activist. You're getting involved in Massachusetts politics. Just talk a little bit about what brought you to politics lately, just so we can get an idea of where you are.
Yeah, okay. So I'm not just anything. I'm a local guy. I grew up in on the South Shore. I grew up in the town of Pembroke. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was actually involved in politics in our town. He was a Republican who was elected to a couple of offices. So I didn't really set out for politics. It was growing up, I didn't really, I kind of got involved in the debate club and stuff like that, but I just never really set out for politics. I took a couple civics classes and such in college. But, you know, lately it's just been, it keeps pulling you in. I mean, just all the decisions that are being made, and the fact that, you know, I have sons of my own and they're going to school and they're masked up, and it's just becoming a situation where it's just getting harder and harder to stay out of it.
Well, it seems like the thing that sparked you to get involved is the state response to the pandemic and the lockdowns and the masking and the forced, and not the forced, but the incredible amount of social pressure to get the vaccines. to the point where there's talk about banning people who don't, you know, who don't get them from the public square altogether. In fact, there was just a poll done a few days ago. I don't know if you saw this, where they said that something like 35% of Democrats think that people who are not vaccinated should be put into concentration camps. It's really very scary, and the society's really become very divided on those kinds of lines. Now, you say that your sons, they have to go to school now with masks on. I mean, to my way of thinking, that's not good science, and it's child abuse, because children and young people, unless they have a pre-existing condition, are not likely to get sick from this disease. So what are your thoughts about that? What's going on in the schools?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, and I've been on so many Zooms lately, whether it be Board of Health and some of these town meetings where, you know, I'll pop in because I'm just really passionate about these topics. And, you know, I saw a study that was done by Brown University that was saying, and I believe it was 26% lower scores,
yes,
due to facial recognition and some of the other social cues that you get just being out and about. And so, you know, I do have real concerns for my own sons that they're going to school masked up, and there's really no science behind it. They're not wearing goggles. So, you know, these masks, in essence, it's really just theater in my mind.
You can take it off for lunch. And, you know, there's something about it that, in my opinion, is un-American, at least culturally, because, you know, we like to communicate with people by seeing their face and knowing what their expression is. It's not just enough to hear them. You know, that's just part of how we are. That's how we communicate. And it sort of does cut off a certain level of communication. You don't know what someone is actually like if you just see their face covered up and you don't know what they look like. You don't know what they really, you know, you can learn things from watching somebody when you talk to them. And there is something about it that it just runs against my grain as an American. And I think the science is faulty.
And I absolutely agree. And, you know, and it's getting so much harder and harder to have actual conversations with other people about it. They'll get scared. They don't want to confront an opposing viewpoint. So they will submit, or they will say, oh, I feel threatened or triggered or offended by what you're saying. And where our society is so used to just having open conversations about things, it becomes a situation where it becomes almost impossible to have a discussion about something that could simply be solved just through a few words.
I mean, I've had that experience. I do think that it, for reasons that are interesting, it has become very political, in that people like myself on the right side, we would tend not to wear the mask unless we absolutely have to. You know, I mean, I'll put it on if I'm in a crowded place and there are people there, just out of, like, you know, respect, and plus you have to, but I'm not going to. I see, whereas people on the left, they're all masked up with double masks, and they're tightening it, and they're yelling, and they're, if you don't wash your hands well enough, they start screaming. And I see them in my neighborhood here in Boston, you know, people on the street with no one around, and they got the mask on. And it does seem to tell you something about where they're coming from politically. Why do you think that is?
You know, I got to say, I think part of it, of course, is based in some sort of illogical fear. When I see somebody walking outside with a mask on, there's no other rationale than that. Is you'll be driving and you'll see somebody outside walking down the street and they have a face mask on and there's no one around for hundreds of feet. And you'll say to yourself, what are they doing? Now, I understand that there's probably some logic in their mind that it's cold outside and they're keeping it on because it might warm them up or something. But at a certain point, we got to take these things off. I mean, we have to take these things off as a society. And it's getting to this strange point where there are some people out there, I don't know if they're ever going to take
the mask off. And they're never going to come out. They'll never go into a restaurant. You know, they'll never, like, you know, there are people who are, I just think that this is it. You know, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I think at this point, my understanding is that the Omicron virus is very mild, and it's probably good for the development of herd immunity. There was recently a statement from the chief immunologist in Israel, which is one of the most vaccinated countries in the world, who has said that he believes that Israel did not do the right thing, that they made a mistake, because now you have to have, there's no immunity, there's no herd immunity, and people are going to get hooked on these vaccines, which actually can ultimately hurt your immune system. So, you know, to get people to get the virus now and get it over with and have immunity seems to me, I mean, I'm not a doctor and I don't give advice. I'm not telling anyone what to do, but it seems to me to be the best natural way forward.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And to follow suit, I am not a doctor, but, you know, I feel as though I'm a healthy person. And so there's a situation where people have to eventually trust their immune system. It just has to come down to that. And so, you know, trusting some other thing is not going to work because, again, I saw a video today of a girl, I believe it was in Illinois, and she was talking to the school board and she had said how she didn't realize that her job as a child was to ensure that triple vaccinated people felt safe in society. And that's the situation that we're coming to. I mean, there are people out there that are triple vaccinated and they still don't feel safe around other
people. In fact, they're the ones that are probably in some ways more likely to actually catch the thing, which brings up the fact that if it's now admitted by the medical rulers, if you will, that getting the vaccine does not prevent you from getting the virus, that's why you still have to wear a mask, then why should they care if someone is vaccinated? That's a personal choice at that point. It's no longer a public health issue. I mean, if it spreads just as much, there's also no real evidence, I don't think, that if someone catches the virus without the vaccine, they're going to get more sick. I think the people that are getting more sick from it, who probably should get the vaccine, in my opinion, are people who are over 80 years old or people who have compromised immune systems due to pre-existing conditions, not the population as a whole.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but the average life expectancy in the country is 79. In Massachusetts, it's actually 80. Mm-hmm. And in the reporting that has come out of COVID in the last 2 weeks, the average age of somebody to perish due to COVID last week was 73. This week it's 74. So the science there to me is that it's obviously the older generation that is in that category where it's right there as it is. I mean, you're 74 years old. That's going to be that age range. And there's no science that says children or teenagers in their healthy prime, need to be vaccinated. This is strictly about
unless they have a pre-existing condition or they're
obese. Absolutely.
You know, obesity is a problem. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of like bad science, the way the whole thing has gone, they've gone about it. So, Chuck, what do you think is going to happen in Massachusetts over the next maybe month or two, given the fact that I think that Governor Charlie Baker has now stated publicly a few days ago that the Omicron virus has peaked and that the numbers have dropped about 40% from its high?
Well, I'll tell you, I personally believe we're in for a wild ride over the next month or two. we're going to watch as political candidates emerge. I think it was one candidate came out today. There was a candidate that came out a couple of weeks ago. So we're going to watch as this politicized virus becomes even more politicized. I mean, I'm sure you saw that in the UK yesterday, they announced no more restrictions. They took them all away.
Yep.
Which and I think find fascinating.
Other countries, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think
we're ratcheting them up. You know, we're actually Mayor Michelle Wu in Boston actually put, and I don't think anyone's paying any attention to it, but she put in an ordinance which says that you have to show an ID to go into a restaurant, a gym, or a public venue. I don't think anyone's doing it. I think people are ignoring it. It's kind of like Attorney General Harry Daugherty during the Coolidge administration famously said, the best way to get rid of a bad law is to enforce it. And yeah. I don't think anybody, there's one viral video showing police telling these, you know, these off-duty cops sitting in a pizza joint in Hyde Park that they had to leave unless they showed their vaccine cards. And they were like, F you, we're not leaving anywhere. And so other than that, I don't think that they're going to, they're just ignoring it because no one's going to do it. It's just not going to happen. I mean,
it's really scary to me. I mean, I don't like any of that. I think that, you know, this goes against us as Americans where we can't be doing this. We can't go down this path. I mean, because it's just going to go to a point where you're going to have to show things that,
show your papers,
you know, yeah, everywhere you go. And it's just not, it's not acceptable. I think this goes against what our forefathers wanted. This goes against what the country was founded on. And, you know, and again, for the mayor to do something like that, it's just really, really, it's really a sad day in the city. And so hopefully, as came out today, Somerville voted down the vaccine passport mandate.
Right.
So that's a great thing. I mean, they did leave a small caveat that they were going to be able to enforce it if some of the other strains got worse or something. But I think that's more, you know, this weird thing that we're going through in our culture where we have to appease the progressive liberals that want to cancel everything. And as I have seen and learned, you can't give in to that. You cannot give in to that. You have to fight back. The moment you give in, it's not over. They're going to take the rest of it. Whatever it is,
that's right.
They're going to cancel you. They're going to stop you.
If you give them a finger, they'll take the whole arm.
That's right.
And you know, the I mean, Somerville's a pretty liberal town. So I think that that's encouraging. Now, you have gotten involved in the gubernatorial race. You've come out in favor of the support of Republican Jeff Diehl. Now, one of the things that's interesting about Jeff Diehl is that he was endorsed by former President Trump and that he proudly recognized this and said, yeah, I'm happy to accept the endorsement of President Trump. That tells me something in this state. It also tells me something that Charlie Baker has decided not to run again because polls showed that he was down something like 60-40 against Jeff Diehl. And then when Jeff Diehl got the endorsement, he dropped even further. So there's something going on in the water right now in Massachusetts. What do you think is going on?
You know, I have to say, I support Jeff Diehl. I've met him personally. He's a South Shore guy like myself. I know he has morals and he has ethics and he has fortitude. And so I think in Massachusetts, I think it's a sleeping giant that is being awakened. And as more and more people see these wild, just drastic tugs at changing our way of life in every aspect of it and not allowing anyone to make their own personal health decisions, make their own decisions when it comes to almost anything, their children, what's happening in the world, you have no say when it comes to these, you know, draconian policies that are being instituted. And so I hope and pray that more and more people wake up and see this and know that they have to fight back. And the way to do that is to get involved and to back candidates that they believe in. And for me, I do believe in Jeff Diehl.
No, I mean, the only minor criticism I would have of Jeff Diehl, and this may not apply to this race, is that when he ran for the Senate against Elizabeth Warren, I just felt that he was too nice. You know, he didn't really take the gloves off at all, you know, and he could have and should have. And I think he would have done better if he had more severely defined himself. The same thing was true in the Boston mayor's race in that Asabi George, she tried to like out Me Too Michelle Wu, even though she had conservative support. She could have at least taken a little, you know, not been so frightened by the Boston Globe. You know, and they're, you know, that you know, you have to kiss the backside of the globe in order to get by. You know,
that's what I think is, you know, there's a lot of yearning for that. I mean, we all know as John McCain, who was sort of, you know, hesitant to really go after former President Obama. You know, we saw how that played out. And that's so hard. I think if, you know, with any of this stuff, there's sort of a sense of being unapologetic for who you are. You know?
And same thing with Mitt Romney. He didn't really take on, whereas Trump, he got right down there and he started swinging and he won. And he took a lot of crap. And of course, I mean, the terrible, vicious attacks on him and his family. But, you know, he's unusual. I mean, he stood up and he presided over what any objective observer would say, a very successful conservative administration.
Now, I mean, look at Trump, the phenomenon that is Trump. How many presidents in our lifetime have you wanted to have three terms, four terms? I mean, the appetite for his supporters to want him to run for the rest of their lives is shows something.
But Chuck, can it work in Massachusetts?
Well, that's the question. That's the question. And I think that again, I mean, just like anything, we're so far out right now that it's like you have to be involved and engaged, and then you got to push it all the way to the finish line. If you don't keep going, if you don't support and keep moving, then as we know, you know, there's a sense of the establishment, and the establishment wins because they're sort of the house, and, you know, and there's that push that the house is going to win because they use all the, you know, all the tentacles that they have to sort of do things that, you know, most of the time it's right on the verge of what is acceptable. And so, you know, as we know, if somebody's in a government office and they're running, it becomes really hard to shake that. But I think, again, we're at a tipping point in our society where if we don't stand up, we're going to get bulldozed over.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And also, Jeff Diehl is not like, even though he's supported by Trump, he's not like a real, you know, hard conservative guy. I mean, he's sort of a moderate, slightly right of center. He's kind of more like a Mitt Romney type of a guy. I mean, he's not like Charlie Baker, who's really a liberal, you know, in disguise. But he's also not, you know, I think that he's inside the Massachusetts Overton window, if you will. I mean, he's not too far out on either side. Now, today, Maura Healey announced that she's running, Attorney General Maura Healey. Maura Healey is a pretty tough figure. When Trump won, she set up, I don't know if you remember this, she set up a hotline so people could drop a dime on Trump supporters. And then she pulled it down after about a week after a lot of criticism. And I think that it's safe to say that the Globe and Healey and the whole rotten, corrupt, liberal Democrat establishment that's running Massachusetts to the ground, their main talking point is going to be that Jeff Diehl is like Trump. I hope that enough people will say, good, we want somebody like that. But I fear that their demonization and their, you know, the anti-Trump kind of cult is going to predominate in this state. What do you think?
Well, to answer to that, I will say, what would they do to any candidate? Probably the same, right? They're going to do that to anyone that enters the race. Yeah, no matter what that candidate does. So again, I think that goes back to the being unapologetic, you know?
But is there enough force to that now? I mean, is there enough Trump? Is the Trump hatred train still like that powerful at this point? I mean, I don't know.
Well, I have to say, I think, you know, at a certain point, how much can you take? I mean, the establishment right now is masking us, gagging us, forcing us to show our papers to, you know, almost to the point where the question is very simple for almost anyone out there. Would you rather die on your feet or live on your knees? I think it's a very simple statement for this whole entire thing.
It is the issue, so, for sure. I mean, the only thing, just one more thing here. Charlie Baker papered the house with absentee ballots, unsolicited, unfilled out, just mailed out, I don't know, 100,000 of them. It wasn't as bad as in some other states where they were mailing out many hundreds of thousands. And there were reports of people getting like 20 ballots in the mail. But it was still pretty bad. And yet, even though Massachusetts is a little bit more conservative than most other states when it comes to absentee ballots. You have to show a chain of custody. They have to check a signature at the clerk's office. You know, if you fill out a fraudulent ballot, you can get in big trouble in the state, including a mandatory jail sentence and a big fine. So we're not as bad as, you know, Arizona and Georgia and some of these other states. But nevertheless, there were suspicions of voter fraud here. Shiva Ayyadari, who I don't endorse, and you know, but he was a legitimate candidate. He made this charge. Do you think that's a problem?
Let me ask you a question, and not to be sort of facetious, but in New Hampshire, we heard of voter fraud where people were actually brought charges against, correct?
Yes, we did.
We did. Did we hear of any of that in Massachusetts?
No.
I kind of think that answers the question right now, that we didn't hear of any of that in Massachusetts. So you're saying that there was, I mean, that's a question you ask yourself. So somehow with all these voter ballots and everything, there was nothing? That seems improbable to me.
It does.
We didn't hear of anything.
Now there's a movement nationally, and I think I've heard that it's sort of percolating in this state, where you have hundreds, if not thousands of people going and volunteering at the polls. They go volunteering to be in the counting rooms when the absentee ballots are counted. You're supposed to have a Democrat and a Republican checking the ballots. That didn't happen last time. And I in a way, I blame Trump for that, in that he didn't see that coming. But now you have people volunteering all over the country in all 50 states, including our state. It's a big, big effort. Are you involved in that? And do you support that?
I definitely do support people going to the polls. I am involved in sort of a small group that is discussing some things on that aspect. But I think really, you know, when we go to that in Massachusetts, it sort of falls onto the Republican Party, where if they don't have the support in those polling places, you know, they've got to really put someone on that and change whatever they did from the last election. I mean, I heard of things even down here on the South Shore where there was a candidate, Tatiana Semirog, who had some issues with counting in her race. And so I think it really has to be a situation where people have to get activated. And again, this goes back to it. If people think, oh, well, someone else is going to do the job for me, that doesn't happen. You have to be the one that gets up and says, you know what, I'm going to take that day off. I'm going to go down to the polls. I'm going to watch the polls. And you have to be ready ahead of time to know if there's any funny business, because that's the moment you have to start. You know, there's sort of a thought that I always have when it comes to some of these things, where it's, you have to throw the flag when the play has happened or is happening, right? Mm-hmm. So you cannot wait until, what a lot of people did in the last election was, the election went through and then they all threw the challenge flag. Where right. It was, they should have challenged in those moments. They should have challenged immediately. And so if you wait often, you know, we could talk about the Patriots. I mean, you know, it's like Bill Belichick, if he sees something wrong, he throws that flag. He doesn't wait.
You have to do it right away. Now, yeah. I mean, I think that a good example is this recent election in Virginia, where you had the Youngkin campaign and the National Republican Committee, which knows that there was major improprieties. They fielded thousands of people. They had a staff of constitutional lawyers waiting on beck and call in case there was anything funny going on. And they really were ready to make sure that every legitimate vote was counted and every illegitimate vote wasn't, and Youngkin won. So I think that if we can repeat that in Massachusetts, that would be amazing. Not that we have the same problems here, we don't, but we do, it's still an issue.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think it just comes down to making sure that people get active in their, you know, in their county, in their towns, and they figure out how to get involved and how to sign up and how to be there.
The local city and town Republican committee, and you know, there are all these offices like clerk, county clerk, city clerk, town clerk. Some cases they've been held by the same person for like 20 years. You can run for those and you can do it with very little money and just get around your town and you can win. And they're great jobs. You know, it's a great thing. You can do it.
Yeah. I mean, take a look at our Secretary of State. How long has he been in there?
He's been there forever. Exactly. He's a, the dark prince.
47 years or something.
Oh my God. And we can thank him for Obamacare, by the way. I don't know if you remember how he did that. I think Ted Kennedy passed away. They Deval Patrick put in like an interim guy, Paul Kirk, out of Kennedy's office. Scott Brown came along and won an upset victory. No one expected that. Came out of nowhere. And the U.S. Senate voted for Obamacare. And Scott Brown was supposed to be there, but he wasn't there because Galvin refused to certify him until after that vote. So we can thank Galvin for Obamacare.
Well, that's again, I mean, that's the tentacles, right?
That's the kind of funny, yeah, that's the old trickery in Mass. That's the old Massachusetts politics. And, you know, I mean, I just think that we have a great opportunity here to change that. And, you know, whether you're a housewife, a teenager, a retired person, empty nester, if you have a little time on your hands and you want to do something to really make a difference in this country and in our state, get involved in local politics. Find out if you can run for local office in your town and do it as a way to say, I'm here to make sure that our elections run right. So,
yeah.
Chuck, what else is, I mean, do you want to send anyone to a website or any information you'd like to share?
Well, I know I saw that there is something this weekend happening at the Paul Revere statue. Okay. So
in the North End.
It's a candlelight vigil. So I would ask everybody to go and check that out. And they want people to bring their own candles. So if you can be there, it's Sunday, the 23rd,
okay.
5 p.m. It's a candlelight vigil. It's Free the Hub, and it's about, stopping forced experimental vaccinations for Boston workers and stopping vaccine passports in Boston. And you can find out more information at freethehub.com or at bfru.us, which is the Boston First Responders website.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And, you know, please keep me posted. I want to make my program available to anyone and everyone involved in all of these movements on a regular basis. That's my contribution. And Chuck, I want to thank you for joining me this evening.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be on. And hopefully I'll come back on in the future when I decide maybe there's something I want to run for.
I hope you do. And I urge everyone to do it. It's very exhilarating to run for office. I did it. It's a great experience. Anyway, thanks a lot, Chuck.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Charles.
All right. Take care.
Oh, one follow-up thing. Can I say one follow-up thing?
Yeah, please.
So my name is Charles. Your name is Charles. And in Mexico, when someone meets their namesake, mm-hmm. they call them Tacayo.
Tacayo, okay.
Tacayo, because, you know, in Mexico, there's so many Juans. So, you know, they just call them Tacayo because they have the same name. So you are my Tacayo.
I am. And your spiritual brother as well. So
that's right. That's right. All right. Have a great night. Thank you.
All right, Chuck. Take care. Thanks.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.